This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program is novelist Ajima Kamau. He is visiting the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign to read from his work as part of the Carr Readers series of the Creative Writing Department in the Department of English. The event is set for 4:30 this afternoon, the 27th of October, in the Author's Corner on the second floor of the Illini Union Bookstore, 809 South Wright Street. And actually, it's the 26th. Today is the 26th. So it is this afternoon, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's this afternoon.
Okay, very good. Ajima Kamau is the author of two critically acclaimed novels, Flickering Shadows and Pictures of a Dying Man. Both novels are set on a fictional Caribbean island, and they are the first two novels in a planned trilogy. The third book will be out next fall. Our guest is has finished the work on the third novel. I just learned that. And so I do want to say about these two first novels, they really draw you into the lives of the people of this imaginary place, the life of this imaginary place. Our guest is a native of Barbados. He earned a master's degree in economics and was for a time an economist for the state of New York, working in Albany. Today he teaches creative writing at the University of Oklahoma. Listeners, I invite you to join the conversation. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And again, the reading this afternoon, October 26th. I'm off to a rocky start here this afternoon, in the Author's Corner on the second floor of the Illini Union Bookstore, and that's at 809 South Wright Street. Ajima, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for inviting me.
What drew you to economics?
Well, it's a long story. When I came to the States to go to university, my grandmother sent me off with the instruction to not to return with a useless degree. So she wanted me to do something practical, which is understandable. And I enjoyed economics as an undergraduate. But then I also went on to do a master's in economics and worked for 3 years at the New York State Tax Department as a senior economist and became disillusioned quite quickly. Yeah. And that's when I started writing again, actually.
Yeah. In your entry on the African American Literature Book Club website, you say the 9-to-5 life in a cubicle there in New York, in Albany, led you to the rediscovery of the creative joy of writing. Would you talk about your first experiences of that joy? Because the word here is rediscovery. Mm-hmm. When did you first discover the joy of writing?
Probably, I would say, in my teen years. In high school, I was fortunate to have a English teacher who was also a published short story writer in Barbados. And creative writing wasn't part of the curriculum, but because he was a publishing writer, he encouraged us to write. And that's when I really found the joy of writing, you know, creating new worlds and going into them.
Yeah.
And I kind of fell by the wayside, you know, as things tend to do. But that was my first discovery of it.
Yeah. And how did you make the rediscovery?
Boredom. Boredom, quite simply. Because, like you just said, I discovered very quickly that the 9-to-5 routine wasn't for me. Plus, I became quite disenchanted with the experience of being an economist in Albany. I discovered that it was quite political. Because our, you know, our job really was to create models to chart the behavior of taxpayers in response to increases and decreases in taxes. But I quickly found out that our real job was to create statistical models that made the governor's policies look good, you know, and that was an eye-opener for me.
Yeah.
So I became disillusioned and started to dabble with writing. And fortunately for me, at the same time, there was a man, Henry Evans. He came up to Albany at this State University of New York at Albany, to do his PhD. And he formed a community writing group in the community center. And one day I just saw this this ad in, you know, in the back of the newspaper asking, you know, if anyone is interested. And out of curiosity, I went around, and we would meet every Thursday. And that's when I really found out that that's what I enjoyed doing,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he encouraged me, you know. He told me that he thought that I had some promise. But his advice, this is advice I always pass on to my students. He told me that was important for me to sit down and ask myself, why I want to be a writer, and what do I want to write about, and how do I want to present it. And, you know, that forced a certain discipline on me in those early stages. And he also encouraged me to apply to an MFA program, because he told me that an MFA program is a terminal degree, and along with the writing probably wouldn't support me. But with an MFA, I probably could get a teaching job.
You could teach, yeah.
Yeah. And I applied to a number of programs. And the one that I was most interested in was the program at VCU, Virginia Commonwealth University, because Paul Marshall was there, because she's an African-American writer. But her roots are in Barbados. Her parents are Barbadian. Well, she was born in Brooklyn. And I've always loved her work, and I wanted to work with her. And I can still remember the day I was at home and got a call from her telling me that I was accepted into the program.
Yeah.
You can imagine the joy of me, Paul Marshall, calling me. But yeah, that's a long answer to your question. That's how I got into it.
Well, back to that first mentor.
Mm-hmm.
How did you answer those questions he posed to you?
Well, what do I want to write about? Mm-hmm. To me, it was important to, as a writer, to hold a mirror up to society. Because the writers I've always respected are those who engage readers in, you know, contemporary issues, and who are not afraid to face the truth, I mean, as they see it. You know, I saw that as part of my role as a writer. How did I want to write? I was, even at that stage, I was interested in trying different ways of writing, because my main influences as a writer were oral storytellers. You know, I grew up in a time when, because television came to Barbados relatively recently in the 70s. So I grew up listening to, you know, people telling stories when the sun goes down. So those experiences are really what informed me. And I wanted to reproduce that on the page as best I could. And that was, you know, that's the way I answered the how. And why? Like I said, because I never saw myself as just an entertainer. You know, and part of it too is just the joy of writing. I just like to create new worlds, you know. And now my profession as a writer is nowhere near as lucrative as my, you know, as when I was an economist. But I'm a much happier person.
Yeah,
much happier person.
Yeah, I started out in college in business, and I got to a certain point, and I said, I can't do this. you know.
So I can relate to that.
And I thought that's a good way to make a living, though, you know. But I thought, no, whatever comes, you know, whatever happens, that'll be it.
Yes.
But I have got to find a different way.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's why I always advise my students to just follow your joy. You know, just do what you enjoy doing. And the financial rewards may or may not come, but at least you won't be miserable.
Right.
Because when I was an economist, I remember very clearly one morning seeing the older guys coming. And you could see they didn't want to be there. That's the last place they wanted to be. And I couldn't see myself growing old, you know, living my life like that.
Yeah.
You know.
You do have a kind of a 9-to-5, though. I mean, you teach, but I would imagine that you would very much enjoy that.
Oh, yeah. Teaching is much more flexible, especially now. Now I just teach in the fall semester. That's the way my contract is. I teach in the fall, so I have the rest of the year to do my own writing.
A lot of freedom.
Yeah. And that works for me because in the fall I can focus on my teaching. You know, and I don't have to worry about shortchanging the students. You know, I can focus on that, knowing that after the semester is finished, I can do my own work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it works. It works for me.
What's your approach to teaching, to working with your students on writing?
Well, one of my main emphases is to let them know that this is not a case where inspiration comes floating down from the sky. You know, it's a job. And I always try to get them to understand that they must have a professional approach. Like, for example, in my case, when I'm writing, I try to do something every day, you know, even if it's only half hour or an hour, because it's a craft. And the more you practice it, you know, the more proficient you're going to become at it. You just can't sit around waiting for the ideas to come. You know, you have to practice it as a craft. I also encourage them to read widely, and not only read the canon or the classics. You know, one of the best pieces of advice I got as a graduate student, I was taking a novel writing workshop, and my instructor, one of his assignments was he asked us to read a novel a week. But his stipulation was reading had to be wide. It had to cover all genres, so from detective fiction to westerns to romance, even pornography, you know. Because his reasoning was, and I tend to agree with him, that you can learn elements of craft from any piece of writing. You know, if some person is writing a good suspense thriller, at least you're going to learn how to pace. You learn, you know, the craft of pacing. So I always encourage my students to do the same, read widely. See what other people are doing, you know. One thing that really ticks me off is a student comes into my class and I ask them what they read, and they say they don't read. I say, well, how can you be a writer if you don't read, you know?
I once was talking with a journalism student who told me she didn't like to read the paper. I thought,
there's something wrong there.
Something's wrong with this picture. So when you begin to work at something, you know, as you said, inspiration just doesn't flow down,
right?
You know, like leaves from the trees.
No.
But where do you find sources, or where do you draw from for inspiration?
It's hard to give a definitive answer to that question. Because, for example, in the first book, Flickering Shadows, that started as a short story. And I just was writing this story about these people in a village. But it grew and to the point where I began to be engaged in the whole notion of post-colonialism, what happens to people in the years after colonialism. And that's what that book ended up being about, you know, about these people in the village and how they were coping with the changes that have happened. And also one of my imperatives in writing that book was to, like I said earlier, my main influences were came from oral storytellers. And so one of my imperatives was to try to convey the language as best I could, you know, without confusing people. Because one of the mistakes I find that especially young emerging writers make when they're trying to convey a dialect is they focus on the phonetics, you know, on the way the words are pronounced. But the essence of language is in the rhythm and the syntax, you know, the way people put words together, mm-hmm. and the music of the language. So one of the things I was trying in that book was to try to convey that as well. So, yeah, and in the second book started as an idea, you know, the idea of identity. I mean, who am I? Am I the person I think I am, or am I the person my mother thinks I am, or am I a combination of all those mm-hmm. things? Who am I really? And, yeah, that started with that idea. So I just killed the guy. And the first pages
of
the book.
That's how it opens. That's how it starts.
Yeah.
That dead body. Also, though, you know, when if you get voices right, then you get character.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and that's very important. I mean, and especially in the second book, that was a challenge because there are so many.
There's so many voices, yeah. So many different characters.
Yes, yeah.
So many different perspectives,
mm-hmm.
which also gets, again, at the idea of identity. Who am I?
Right.
In this case, who is the dead man?
Yeah, yeah.
And also, who are we in the community
exactly.
together?
Exactly, yeah. And sometimes I go to readings or maybe a colleague would invite me to, you know, talk to their class if they're teaching my book. And they would ask me, who do I think Gladstone is? I said, that's not the point. Who do you think he is? And you get all these different ideas, you know, these opinions of who this man is. And yeah. I find that quite fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Well, on the one hand, though, Gladstone, I think maybe it is helpful to know that he's a son, he's a husband, he's a bureaucrat,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing. So.
Yeah, he's all of those things.
And he's the dead man.
Yeah.
For listeners, they need to know that. Well, would you read an excerpt from Pictures of a Dying Man?
Sure, certainly. I'd be happy to do that. Yeah, I'll read from one of the chapters titled Sunny Boy. And Sunny Boy, for the listeners' information, he is the father of the dead man. So it was that the day after Gladstone Bell died, when a taxi stopped in front of the house where he'd grown up, the wooden house where his mother still lived, gossip shifted from the deceased former deputy prime minister and his widow, and lit on the man who got out of the backseat of a taxi and stood waiting while the driver hefted a suitcase from the trunk of the car. An elderly man dressed in shiny black pants, a short-sleeved plaid shirt with a button-down collar and a brown felt hat. Who that? Well, 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 look my chaos crosses. It's Sonny Boy. Sonny who? Sonny Boy, Gladstone's father. Sonny Boy? Sonny Boy that living in a way all these donkey years. Look like a way and do a thing for him. Look him in shirts and pants like if he just went down the road for a walk and one stinking suitcase. So the gossip goes. And so on it went, with one person saying how he must have shipped a burial separate and another voice chiming in wanting to know what burial. Sonny Boy was always cheap and stingy from since he was small, so it shouldn't surprise anybody that he would come back after all these donkey years and not bring back even a kerchief for nobody. Sonny Boy took his suitcase and walked toward the house he left so many years before, wondering if this really was the house he, Esther, and Gladstone used to live in. The thing was smaller than his garage back in Florida. The whole country had shrunk while he was away. Driving from the airport, roads that he could swear used to be major highways now were so narrow and winding that he sat in the back seat of the car, gripping the armrest on the door and expecting a head-on collision any minute, for Christ's sake. When the taxi driver had to pull into the gutter so that the bus coming toward them could squeeze by, he asked the taxi driver, "They're using bigger buses over here now, eh, partner?" To which the taxi driver sucked his teeth, and Sonny Boy could see the scorn in the man's eyes in the rearview mirror. And he imagined the taxi driver call him all kind of chiggerfoot country buck who come back acting as if he is a tourist. But he, Sonny Boy, wasn't pretending. Not like his friend Clement's sister, who went away for 14-day vacation years back and came home asking in a Yankee accent, "Where's the fish market?" "The fish what?" people asking. And even Clement laughing at his own sister to see how stupid she behaving. And Sonny Boy chuckling now at that long ago memory. No, he wasn't like that. The place really looked small. The taxi turned off the highway, and for a moment he thought the driver had the wrong address. Because before his eyes was a collection of small houses, huddled higgledy-piggledy and separated by alleyways where half-naked children ran around yelling and playing. Fowls scratched in the dust, and mangy dogs and hungry-looking cats looked as if the hot sun had drained all the energy from their scrawny bodies. This wasn't the village he had left 20 years ago. Couldn't be. Because this village main road that was a good-sized highway in his memory now had shrunk to the size of the alley behind his house in Florida. An alley barely wide enough for the garbage trucks that came every Friday. He looked through the car window up at the Springer's house on the hill high above the village and remembered leaving nearly 30 years ago, intending to save some money and come back and build a bigger mansion nearby on the same hill, where he would come out on his balcony in his robe, just like a movie star, and look down on the village where he used to live and enjoy a life of tropical retirement with Esther. But now it's not the wonderment of old that he's feeling, but shock as he stares at the pitiful little cream-colored bungalow perched on the hill with its open carport. Hell, even he had an enclosed garage, and he didn't have no car. Probably no more than 3 small bedrooms, living room, and kitchen. And he's realizing that his house in the States is bigger than this mansion he'd carried around in his memory all these years. In that moment, looking up at the Springer's house on the hill, Sonny Boy's mind was not on legacies, as he felt behind his eyes and his chest such a deep sense of loss that if he wasn't a man, he would have allowed the tears to pour from his eyes right there. All these years while he was away, this was a place he knew he would be coming back to. Home. All these years he refused to apply for American citizenship, hanging on to his identity, his memory of home. "I ain't no minority," he would always insist. He noticed that sometimes this would tick off people, especially when he added half-jokingly, "I have a country." But he didn't care. He rejected the inferiority the word minority implied, and he did have a country. But now here he was, back for his son's funeral, and it was like visiting a foreign land. It would have been better if he hadn't come back at all. Then at least his village would have been preserved in his memory, remaining as it was when he left. But here he was, looking around at a strange small place that wasn't home. This wasn't the country he left years ago and stored in his memory all this time. With suitcase still in hand, he walked around the house, saw the backyard and gazed at the lush green of the fruit trees on the slope of the hill behind the house he'd helped build, and at the cultivated plot at the bottom of the valley that Esther farmed, and which he helped her with a little bit until he left for America. Of course, Miss Esther will tell you different. But Miss Esther was no ten. But Miss Esther no tended by herself. Yeah. She will always tell you that was always the case.
Yeah.
That's just a short excerpt.
Thank you for reading that, Ajima Kamau, pictures of a dying man, and. Ajima is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, with a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener waiting for us on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I agree completely with your guest and you. I used to be a very voracious reader, but for reasons of health, I can't. Can he respond to that, or you? And I'll listen.
Can he respond to?
To the fact that I used to be a voracious reader, but disease has made me not one.
How can I respond to that?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a terrible thing to lose.
Yes, it is, because, see, people, like I was telling a friend of mine earlier, today's generation is a visual generation, meaning they receive their stimulation from video games and from TV and so forth. But there's nothing like reading words and creating worlds in your own imagination, you know. So it's a terrible thing to lose that ability. To read and enter worlds in your mind.
We do have, though, marvelous books on compact
on tape.
And that's a wonderful way to experience a story, too. Yeah. As you know, you were talking about how wonderful the oral culture is and really what it's meant for you as a writer.
Yeah.
It's been a great gift.
Right.
So to listen to stories is a wonderful thing.
That's true. I mean, that's the closest you could come to the actually probably dead practice of just sitting around listening to people tell stories. I mean, that's the closest you could come to it now. And another thing that I missed coming here is listening to radio plays. There doesn't seem to be a tradition of that in this country. Maybe there was.
There was. And there are some places where you can still find them. Mm. On our companion station, the FM station, there's some performance pieces that are done. I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but yeah.
So yeah, I can sympathize with the listener, because I wouldn't know how it would feel if I lost that ability.
Yeah. What do you say we talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. I just heard the previous caller say she was no longer able to read, and I'm kind of in that category myself. Would like to tell her that you can get information on the Talking Book program from your library, and they actually mail talking books to your home. It's free if you have a disability like that. You'll need a doctor's signature, but it's a super wonderful program. It takes a little bit of adjusting, but it's very worth it.
Well, thanks for the call. Well, that's a nice piece of advice there. Anybody else would like to join us? Please do. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL.
That's really interesting. Sound like you have a real sense of community here.
Yeah.
One person calls in and the other person calls in.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I remember some years back, there's a program at the University of Illinois where you can read readings for students who are blind or who have difficulty reading.
Mm, okay.
So, you donate a couple of hours a week to sitting down in front of a microphone and you read.
Actually, I don't know why I didn't respond, but my mother had lost her sight before she passed. So my older brother would buy her some tapes, and she really appreciated that. And she would listen to TV, interestingly enough.
Sure, yeah. And also, you know, if you've got a friend, it's wonderful to have a friend or your spouse or someone.
To read to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great joy. It goes all the way back to when we were children. Back to Sonny Boy and that excerpt that you read. It's Sonny Boy has some faults.
As do we all.
Yeah, as do we all. But we like him, nonetheless. It's very difficult for him to come back, isn't it?
Yeah, and part of that was a reflection of my own experience. Because I just finished reading a book called Cool AIDS by Rabbi Alameddin. He's a Lebanese-American writer. I think he lives in San Francisco. And there's a quote in his book that sticks in my mind. It goes, in Lebanon, I fit, but do not belong. In America, I belong, but do not fit.
Mm.
And that has been my dilemma. And I think that's pretty much the immigrant's dilemma. And I think that's Sonny Boy's dilemma as well, because he has this home in his memory.
Mm-hmm.
But when he returns, it's nothing, you know, like the home that he had in his head all these years.
Yeah.
And as he said, it probably would have been better if he hadn't returned at all, you know. And that's something that's always been of concern to me.
Yeah. Well, before I launch into that, why don't you say we take another call instead of keeping this listener waiting? We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line 4 in Kankakee. Hi.
Earlier you were talking of those who write but who do not read, perhaps an unusual situation. For the purposes of discussion, however, let us posit that a skillful writer might emerge who is not a reader, but one engaged in oral culture. Would it not be possible for one to be a good communicator, even in writing in these days, even though he does not read? The technology is available now for the production of oral communicators to be reduced to writing. Is not what is significant the conveyance of the thought, the story, the message, or whatever the content might be, independent of the communicator's familiarity with the canon of the literature, the art, or the science which preceded the communicator's production? And is not the video and the audio and, of course, the live performance more powerful than the book? Thank you.
I don't know if they're more powerful than the book. I don't discount them as media of communication. And yes, I do agree. Some person could be quite an effective writer who's not reading. But by not reading, I think you deprive yourself of you know, part of the spectrum of communication. Because writing, it really is an act of putting words on the page, and it helps to read those who've also put words on the page to see how it's been done. So I think you'd be depriving yourself by the same token, I also support those who pay attention to popular culture and see how people are communicating in those media. One interesting thing I'm noticing more and more, especially in my students, that more and more this generation of writer are being influenced by movies, the way movies are put together structurally. You read a lot of literature, you can almost see the camera techniques, in some of the writing. But I think you can be an effective writer, but I think you'll be really depriving yourself if you don't, immerse yourself and pay attention to what other writers are doing. You know, rather than trying to reinvent the wheel is already there. So look at the wheel and see how you can improve it.
Yeah.
Agreed. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. The question of identity, back to Sonny Boy. One thing that I've noticed about, I've had the great good fortune to be able to visit an island off the eastern coast of Canada from time to time. And there is such a strong sense of island in the native's identity. You might hear someone say, her husband is from the mainland. And I find that so interesting. And here is, so not only do you have home, you know, but you have a very particular kind of home.
Mm-hmm.
How does the island, from your perspective, shape identity, your own identity?
Well, on one level, there's a kind of, I don't want to sound harsh, but there's a kind of parochialism that you really can't escape by being raised and living on an island. I mean, you're surrounded by water and, you know, there's certain fixed boundaries. So on that level, let me backtrack a bit. One of the things that struck me when I came to this country is how easily people move from one location to another. In islands, that tend not to be the case. You know, one tends to stay in limited in one. So there's a certain limitation, I think, from being born, raised, and living on an island that doesn't occur on a larger landmass because there's no opportunity. See, and the thing is, the flip side to that is when you do leave an island, you've left.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like crossing a border, like going from, from New York to New Jersey or something like that. You know, it's a departure. So it's a very strong tie to an island. We have a saying in Barbados, home is where your navel string was buried. It's an old saying, but it's very much kind of an island saying. You know, that's home. That's where you're from.
The thing that immediately comes to my mind is you feel the pull.
Yeah, you feel that pull. Yes,
you feel the tide.
Yes, yeah. You do.
And I've also overheard conversations, say on the ferry, you know, people recognizing one another, and somebody hasn't been home for a while. They've had to leave to make a living.
Yeah,
you're coming back. You're coming home.
Mm, yeah, and in the Caribbean, there's a lot of that. Even from, I would say late 40s right through 50s, 60s, there's always been a lot of migration to the metropolis. First it was England, because in the case of Barbados, because Barbados was a British colony, and then it was Canada. Now it's more so the United States. But in most cases, it's for economic opportunity. You see a lot of movement back and forth. The thing about that, though, is that people leave the best of intentions. Leave the intention to return. It's, like Sonny Boy said.
Like Sonny Boy.
Yeah, you know.
I'm coming
just going
back and I'm going to build a house.
Yeah, I'm just going to make some money and I'm going to return. But it never happens. Well, it happens very rarely, you know. And that's one of the, that's one of the things we have to deal with.
Yeah. You know? The question of identity is really at the heart of Pictures of a Dying Man. And that question of, you know, who we are individually, who you are, who we are collectively, those questions, did they lead you to tell the story the way you do, the form of the story?
Yeah.
How the narrative unfold?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the form was very much part of, you know, the substance of the story, because the nature of the story is that there are all these different people telling these different stories about Gladstone Bell, including Gladstone Bell telling his own stories through his diary entries and so forth. So, yeah, so it definitely could not have been a linear structure. We have a beginning, middle, and ending, you know, the classic, Aristotelian model. It had to be fragmented. And that created a number of headaches. I mean,
how do you keep all those voices?
It was very straight. Difficult. It was really very difficult. I ended up having to write an index, say like page 50, Sonny Boy, page 50 to 55, Sonny Boy, page 55 to 60, Esther, that sort of thing, so that I know what I'd already done. Yeah. Otherwise, I could have found myself going around in circles. Yeah.
And I would imagine, too, from day to day, you hear one voice talking to you when you sit down to work, and you say, wait a minute, Esther's calling, or Isamina is calling, I've got to pay attention.
Yeah, that's true. I couldn't go in with any fixed notion of what I wanted to do, which was exciting.
Yeah. You know,
that's what I love about writing, because for me, the joy of writing is the discovery. For me, it's a process of discovery. And after the book is finished, it's finished. You know, it's in the public domain.
Yeah.
You know,
But
the joy for me is while I'm discovering.
Well, that's a beautiful link between writer and reader, isn't it?
It is. It is. It is. You know, I do my thing, and any reader does his or her thing. Yeah. You know, I bring their experience to it.
Yeah. Now, this is a trilogy. The first one, Flickering Shadows. Then this one. What's the title of the forthcoming?
The third one is tentatively titled Secrets. And it's about what happens in families when secrets are held. You know, and I don't know, maybe most families do it, I don't know. But there's certain things that you would think that families would discuss. And when those things aren't discussed, it could cause really devastating impacts. So that's loosely what...
Ghosts.
Yeah.
Which is part of the story, too, of pictures of a dying man. What holds these three books together as a trilogy?
That's interesting how that came about. I never intended to write a trilogy. Like I said, it started as a short story while I was in the MFA program, and it evolved into a novel. And then when the first book came out, Flickering Shadows, I went to a book fair festival, and Alan Kornblum, the publisher, editor of Coffee House Press, he was sitting around talking, and he said, well, why don't you, have you ever thought about doing a trilogy? Because, you know, people were coming up to the table and asked, well, when is the second book coming out? Gee, they said, you know, just finish the first. And he said, you know, a trilogy may be a good idea. And I started, then that's how the idea of a trilogy came along, just more as a challenge than anything. Unfortunately, I'd killed off most of the characters in Flickering Shadows.
Yeah.
So I just had to do some creative thinking. And so some characters do reoccur, you know, in the second book and in the third. And it loosely connected in terms of characters who reoccur, but also some of the themes that reoccur, and also place, location.
You're probably, I'm only guessing, but you're probably pretty fortunate that when the characters are done in a particular book, you're finished.
Mm-hmm.
Go read it. Buy it, read it, enjoy it.
Yeah.
I'm finished.
Right.
My part's done. Because, you know, if you couldn't do that, then how do you... You get out of bed the next morning and start with a new, I want to meet some new folks.
Right.
Yeah. And I have talked with writers who it's very difficult once it's done.
To let it
to
go?
To leave it alone.
I know.
And some writers keep writing about the same character. You know, they really stick with a character. And that can be fun for readers as well, too.
Yeah. You know, everybody has his or her own way of doing things. That's just my way of doing it. And, you know, although when I'm finished with a book, I'm finished. And I still, for example, when I go to a reading and I see a passage and I see something that makes me cringe, I will you know, rewrite it, even though it's, you know, the book is not rewritten, but I would change things around. You know, I'm always dabbling that way. But as far as the overall book is concerned,
it's very interesting. I've had poets on the program who will read a poem and they'll change it.
Yeah.
In the reading of it.
Yeah.
And it's like, but it's in the book the way it is. Very interesting.
Actually, I did a little bit of that a few minutes ago.
I couldn't tell because you have my book. So, well, we're out of time.
I really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much for inviting me. I'm really glad you were able to come in and talk with us this afternoon. Ajima Kamau. And he will be this afternoon at 4:30. He will be in the author's corner on the second floor of the Alana Union Bookstore at 809 South Wright Street for a reading. He is the author of Flickering Shadows and Pictures of a Dying Man, and the third book, tentatively titled Secrets. Out in fall of 2007. Again, thank you very much. And
thank
the publisher, Coffee House Press.